Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast.
I recently interviewed longtime reporters Don Bartlett and James Steele regarding their new book, The Betrayal of the American Dream, looking at the relentless economic, financial, and governmental process over the last almost 40 years to enrich the largest corporations and richest individuals at the expense of the middle class. Today, I will talk with Pulitzer Prize winner Hedrick Smith, another wise and experienced reporter with a long-term perspective, about his newest book, Who Stole the American Dream? And I don't think it's a coincidence, nor do I think it's redundant to turn so soon to the same questions being pursued by another savvy journalist. Hedrick Smith had already won a Pulitzer by 1973, the year that the post-World War II boom for the middle class began to wane. Real wages for all Americans had risen pretty consistently from the war years, and have done so almost not at all ever since. I point this out to highlight the fact that Smith has witnessed firsthand the rise and long fall of the middle class and brings that experience to this book and to this conversation. Hedrick Smith is a best-selling author, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, and Emmy Award-winning producer. His books, The Russians and The Power Game, were critically acclaimed bestsellers and are widely used in college courses today. As a reporter with the New York Times, he shared a Pulitzer for the Pentagon Papers series and won a Pulitzer for his international reporting from Russia in 71 to 74. Smith's primetime specials for PBS have won several awards for examining systemic problems in modern America and offering insightful, prescriptive solutions. His latest book is Who Stole the American Dream? Welcome, Hedrick Smith.
Terrence, I'm delighted to be with you. Thanks.
Very good. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. So can you briefly tell us about your path to the work you do today? Not so much this new book, we'll get into that, but your overall sense of your work, and feel free to mention mentors or turning points or moments of decision that led you to where you are today.
Well, it's going to sound funny. I was born in Scotland of American parents who loved Europe and loved to travel, and they imbued that in me as I grew up, even in America when we moved back to America, which I did when I was 6 or 7 years old. So the idea of being a foreign correspondent, traveling the world, seeing the world, was something that was embedded in me long before I knew I wanted to be a journalist. That's very important. I'm a reporter's reporter. I like to go talk to people, people high and low. Ordinary people, hear their stories, understand what's going on. And I'm a guy who likes to put pieces together. I think that the public is overwhelmed by bits and pieces of news that they can't use. Yes, it titillates them today, it informs them today, but they don't know how the pieces fit together. So I'm a guy who likes to put pieces together. You just mentioned the Russians. You just mentioned the power game. When I went to Russia in the 1970s, as the bureau chief for the New York Times in Moscow, somebody said to me, why don't you write a book, Why They Behave Like Russians? and that's what I did. I didn't call it that, but that's what I was. So instead of saying, it's communism, it's the system, what are the people like? And I loved it. And I actually think people responded well, because Americans, by the time my book came out, were enormously curious about what the Russians were like. The power game. I spent years as a reporter in Washington, covering Washington. But when I came back from Russia, I thought, what if I were to approach Washington as if I were a correspondent from some other country?
I like that.
What if I were a foreign correspondent in Washington?
Yeah.
How would I look at Washington? What would the anatomy of Washington look like? What would I be interested in? And the latest who's up, who's down, who's winning, the latest piece of legislation would matter less to me than how do some people win and why do other people lose? And why does something get done in Congress and why does something not get done? And how does the press corps feel about the president? But people don't understand. People think that reporters in the White House press corps, for example, react to the president by their ideology, by their party. dead wrong. They react to them by whether or not they like them. Ronald Reagan got a terrific press from the White House press corps, most of whom were probably Democrats at the time, because they loved Reagan. He was such a likable guy. And Jimmy Carter got a bad press because he had those cold, blue, steely eyes, and people didn't like him. I remember once going in to interview Reagan with Les Gelb, who later on became the head of the Council on Foreign Relations and a member of the administration, Democrat, in a Democratic administration, foreign policy expert. We went in and we interviewed Reagan. And we came out after 45 minutes or an hour. And I was totally frustrated because Reagan had succeeded in avoiding answering all the good questions we had. He'd fluffed us off. He'd beaten us totally at the information game. And I was expecting Les to be furious because he had been highly critical of Reagan's policies and some of the stuff he'd written. And he turned to me and said, "What a great guy. Do you like Reagan?" And that absolutely epitomized it to me. He had totally lost. First place, he was I'd interviewed Reagan before. He'd never interviewed Reagan. So in the first place, he was just impressed with being in the Oval Office.
Sure.
The other thing was, he'd responded to Reagan as a human being, not as a policy spokesman for the Reagan White House. It was so funny. So I'm fascinated by the way these things work, and I like to try to put it together. So that leads to where this book is. I was trying to put together a story. I'm a reporter. I'm trying to answer questions and put together the story.
Oh, but also, can you talk a little bit about, because you've made such a part of your career, the work on documentaries. What takes a reporter who says, you know what? I want to put this in an hour-long PBS special. I want to put this in a four-segment PBS miniseries. What was that about?
Well, what happened was I'd spent 30 wonderful years working for the New York Times and before that working for United Press International. I covered some of the best stories in the world. I covered the civil rights movement. I covered the Vietnam War. I'd been in Moscow at the height of the Cold War. You couldn't ask for a better front row seat to history than I had been given by my employers for the previous three decades. But I had done daily journalism for a hell of a long time. And I knew by that point that when we write daily journalism, we're doing history in salami slices.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing history on the fly. There's no, you know, there are gaps in your reporting. You know you haven't finished it all. You know there's stories you've missed. You know there's stuff you'd like to be able to put together and explain better. So when I got into the documentary business, I saw that as the opportunity. Those documentaries, by the way, I got into the documentary business literally through book writing. And there are important similarities there. There's a similarity is this. An hour-long documentary, like a book, has to have an architecture. If you're doing a two-minute story or you're doing a one-day piece, you can spot the lead, you can spot the highlights, you can write it quickly and get it done. If you're going to write a book, it's like designing a house or designing a building. There's got to be a front door. There's got to be a living room. There's got to be a dining room and a kitchen and a back room and a yard and bedrooms upstairs. It's all got to fit together. It's got to have a flow. It's got to have an architecture. Well, the same thing is true of a book, and it's also true of a long-form documentary. That documentary, every 4 or 5 minutes, has got to be teaching you something you didn't know. It's constantly got to be peeling one more layer off the onion. And that's a great challenge, and it's really interesting. And I'd moved in that direction when I was working at the New York Times. I was writing more and more magazine articles, 5,000 words instead of 800 words. I was taking 6 weeks or 3 weeks to report them. And I just had the urge to do things in greater depth.
Yeah.
To be able to do them more in the round. And I'd done the other. I'd had a lot of fun doing it. No complaints about it. I was just ready for another stage in my career, for more growth. And so what I did, actually, was I wrote the book, The Power Game, How Washington Works. And then somebody came to me from PBS and said, you know, why don't you work with a producer, a guy named Phil Burton, who's a wonderful producer, sadly has passed away now, but wonderful producer for CBS Reports for a long time. He's got an idea for doing some documentaries on Washington and how power works in Washington. He said he's talking to the people up at the Kennedy School at Harvard. He's going to do a 13-part series. So I talked to him. He said, I'm going to do 13. I said, so why are you doing a 13-part series? Well, it's academic, and there are 13 weeks in an academic term, and I'm going to do one story on each of the 13 departments of the federal government, you know, the Department of Housing, Department of Transportation, Department of Education. I said, oh, my God, why are you going to do that? It's going to be terribly boring. He said, why? I said, because they're all the same, except for the Pentagon and the Justice Department. They all operate the same way. They all operate through iron triangles. They have certain influence groups that affect the legislation, certain committees, and so on. So if you understand one of them, you understand the others. The only thing that changes is the subject and the players. He said, so what would you do? Well, I'd take it apart and try to analyze, you know, what works in Congress, what works on the Hill, what works in the White House. I'd analyze the coalition game, how you put political coalitions together. I'd analyze the agenda game, how you get agendas in front of the public and in front of the media. I'd analyze the media game. Oh, he said, that sounds interesting. He said, where can I find that out? I'm writing a book about that. Oh, he said, oh, I'd love that. When's the book coming out? I said, what's going to take me 6 months or more? I've already been writing on it. He said, I can't wait that long. I said, go do the Justice Department. I'm not going to do the Justice Department. Justice Department is different from any other department.
Sure,
in the Pentagon. I said, so go do the Justice Department with Fred Graham, who was then the Justice Department correspondent for the New York Times. That's exactly what he did. 6 months later, we formed a partnership, and we put together a book based on my book, The Power Game. We did a four-part PBS series, and it was great because it introduced me to television. I said, in long-form television, I said, wow, this is fun. I got to do this. The next thing I did was Gorbachev's USSR, Perestroika, 4 hours on that. And then I said, well, I'm going to set up my own company and make documentaries. So it was a very natural kind of development. It was just a reporter happily continuing to grow. I mean, to me, the greatest fun of being a reporter is that you're constantly learning something. You know, if you're repeating yourself, time to move on.
Exactly.
You know, get somewhere else.
Let me tell people, I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with Hedrick Smith. We're going to talk about his new book, Who Stole the American Dream. Right now, we're talking about some of his career that has led up to that. And to learn more, you can go to HedrickSmith.com, and I'm going to spell it for you, H-E-D-R-I-C-K, Hedrick Smith, one word, HedrickSmith.com. Hedrick, I wanted to say what you were saying about the difference between a book and an article. I do hour-long interviews, which in radio is, I'm very, very lucky. I don't have to do the 8-minute segments one after another. Yet when I went to a publisher and sort of wanted to turn it into a book, he said, so what's the theme that unites all the interviews? What's the theme that unites what you're, these pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work that you're talking about? It's not enough to, you know, to put pieces in different areas or under different names. What's the theme? So I really hear what you're, and I have yet to come up with that exactly, so I really hear what you're saying.
Yeah, well, that's the trick, and it's not just a trick, it's very important, and that to me is the fun, and that's the challenge, and because it makes it larger, you know, and I've been doing this a long time. I want to try to make more sense out of things for myself as well as for other people, and so, you know, like a good reporter, I start with good questions, and I just keep pursuing them. And this book, by the way, I need to confess to you, this is not the book that I set out to write.
Uh-huh. Tell me.
My contract with my publisher says The Dream at Risk.
Uh-huh.
Which is not Who Stole the American Dream. It was, I didn't start out with a thesis and then work like hell to prove it. I started out with a bunch of questions. I knew the middle class was in trouble. Everybody knows the middle class is in trouble. People have lost their jobs. They lost their homes. You know, they're worried about their kids in the future. So that was easy. How do we move from an era of middle class prosperity, which I had seen personally myself? I'd lived through it. I'd experienced it. I'd benefited from it in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, coming out of college and beginning my career in those years. And then I'd seen the decline. How do we move from an era of middle-class prosperity and middle-class power, and by power I mean civil rights movement, environmental movement, consumer movement, all having powerful impact, all coming from the belly of the country, having powerful impact on Washington, changing policy, forcing the White House and Congress to adapt to what the public wanted, not the other way around, to an era of partisan gridlock, unequal democracy, lopsided inequalities in the economy, the super rich, the 1% and the 99%. This is a wacko different world. They're both America. And everybody today, I guess anybody at any era assumes that life was always the way it is when you live. Not true. Not true in other countries, and certainly not true in this country. And so that change is what fascinated me. And the more I dug into it, and the more I began to look at what happened in housing, and then what happened in retirement, and then what happened in job offshoring, and then what happened in the political system, the more I began to see patterns. And it didn't just happen to the middle class. It was done to the middle class.
Absolutely.
There was a political revolution that started in the 1970s, and that revolution is what has wound up by stealing the American dream. And it's not like there was a cabal, there was a plot, there were 12 guys sitting around the table saying, how can we screw the middle class? But it was a class of people. It was the corporate leadership, and they were sparked by a particular Paul Revere that I hope we can talk about.
Oh, we will. We will.
So I began to see that story unfolding, and the pieces started to fall in place, and then it got more complicated again, and more pieces fell in place. And so I feel like I've got a pretty good grasp of it now, and I don't know about you. I feel this is really important. I think we're not going to get a good fix in this country if we don't understand how we got where we are and what the nature of the real problems are. And I don't think the political dialogue in this campaign is helping people understand that one whit.
No. As a matter of fact, I mean, one of the ways that I often look at things is something broken? How did it get broken? How do we fix it? You know,
that's the right sequence.
Those three questions, and obviously, you know, one could say the middle class in America is broken. Then the question is, how did it get broken? Because unless you know that. And that thing that you said, in preparing for this, I thought the same thing, that there are people, maybe not people of, you know, who've been looking at this since the 60s or the 50s or the 40s, but certainly an awful lot of people in America who just think this is the way it is. Can I ask, and you can say no to this question, but I did, as I was preparing for this, want to put off the book for one more question. Which is, as we record this interview, the Chicago school teachers are on strike. And it seems to be over testing and evaluation as much as money. You focused a lot of your attention on education. You did PBS specials, Challenge to America in 94, Surviving the Bottom Line in 98, Making Schools Work in 2005. As you look at education today, what do you see? Is it broken? How did it get broken? How do we fix it? That sort of thing. I would just love if you want to take a crack at that, and then we'll go back to the middle class.
Yeah, well, it is broken, but we got to understand that the challenge has changed. And so the system that we had that was a mass production educational system was designed for a mass production economy. So if you got a lot of people through high school and they had reasonable skills in English, and they could do a bit of arithmetic, and they knew a bit of social studies and how the system worked, they could go get a job, you know, in the Walmart of that time, in the General Motors. They could do all kinds of work. They could come out of high school without an advanced education, without understanding high technology or computerized equipment and that kind of stuff, and move into the economy of the time without needing a lot of specialized education. Now fast forward 30 years. If you want to be a health worker in America, you better be able to not only understand how the computer works, but how to do statistical analysis, because you're going to have to record people's EKGs or their blood pressure. I mean, being a health technician today is more complicated than it was 30 or 40 years ago. The technology and the health system requires it. Same thing is true in industry. You better be able to do CAD/CAM, computer-aided design, computer-aided manufacturing. It's required more. If you're going to be a Bell telephone line engineer and go out and repair telephone lines, you've got to understand how the digital world works. And that's a different math than the earlier math. I mean, so the demand on the public educational system and the level of education you got to be able to compete with is much higher. And you're competing now. You're not competing. West High is not competing with South High.
Right.
West High is competing with Toyota City. It's competing with Copenhagen High. It's competing with Hamburg High. And let me tell you, those educational systems around the world are better than ours. It's embarrassing, but they're better than ours. They do a much better job, you know, teaching the fundamentals, demanding the fundamentals, and pushing people. And Americans, basically want to complain about their educational system, but they don't want to do something about it. The minute you say there's something wrong with our local school system, unless there's a fight over the superintendent that people don't like, they basically say, well, yeah, there's a problem in the American educational system, but ours is fine.
Right.
Or we're doing okay in Indiana. I don't want the federal government coming in here and telling us what to do. Federal government shouldn't be telling you what to do. But you in Indiana, or you in California, or you in Texas, or you in Connecticut, you don't know what they're teaching in 10th grade biology in Tokyo, or in Beijing, or in Hamburg, or in Stockholm. And if you don't know that, you don't know what is world competitive biology high school teaching. And that's where the federal government can help you. And people are resistant to that. They want local control. And they don't want to have to adjust to the global standards. So we're broken in that sense. We've got to get much more global in our educational thinking, or we're going to continue to fall behind.
No, that's very interesting, because when people talk, we do. We cherish education is a local thing. It's one of the last things that sort of is local, right? And yet, usually people think it's local versus state or local versus federal. What you're saying is it's local versus global.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so if you're going to be honest about what's best for your kid.
I don't want to get away from this subject in a minute, but I've looked at high school physics and biology and science in places like Philadelphia and Hartford and so forth, and it is not as tough as it is in Munich, or as tough as it is in Copenhagen, or as tough as it is in Singapore, or as tough as it is, believe it or not, in Beijing and Shanghai, where I've actually filmed in schools. We're behind them. We're not as tough in what we demand. And if we don't get with it, our kids are not going to have a secure economic future.
I mean, this, in a way, the education crisis is tomorrow's middle class crisis, right?
It's today's middle class crisis. Sorry, it's not tomorrow's. Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of middle class crises, and I hope we can get to health care and retirement and issues like that, offshoring and whatnot as well. But it's today. It's not tomorrow. It's with us. We got to do everything smarter, but we've also got to get back to working together. We're still fighting each other as if we had the luxury of doing that. We don't have that anymore.
Right. This is the voice of Hedrick Smith. We're talking about the middle class. We're talking about his book, Who Stole the American Dream? And to learn more, go to Hedrick Smith, one word, H-E-D-R-I-C-K, Smith.com. One last thing on education before we move. So what should listeners do? Where can they – I mean, you've set it up as a very different challenge than you usually hear. You usually hear it's about standards, it's about testing, it's about those things, which all seem to be fights between different governments or unions and so on, when in fact America is hurting and needs a much bigger picture. Where can listeners learn more, and how could they get involved?
Well, I've presented a challenging picture, but if you go to look at our documentary, Making Schools Work, that is entirely devoted to 7 models of effective education, either at the school level or at the district level, and I didn't do any examples of individual schools with great superintendents or great principals or inspiring teachers. I insisted that absolutely every example we used be working in at least 100 schools so it can be replicated. You can't get genius educators into every school.
Right.
You've got to have some kind of system that works everywhere. And so that's what we did. We went for those, and I can tell you the 7 models that I picked reached over 2 million kids. If those 7 models can work for those 2 million kids, there are models out there. So the first thing that Americans need to do is to get rid of NIH, not invented here. They got to get rid of the notion that their school system is going to come up with a perfect solution at home, and don't tell us anybody else how to do it. We don't have time for that. We have got to go get the best models, the best examples, the best work that we can find anywhere in the country or anywhere else in the world.
Okay, Hedrick, if people want to get a hold of that documentary, Making Schools Work, can they go to your website to find it?
Yeah, they can go to our website, but probably the best thing to do is just send us an email, hsmithprod, hsmithprod, hedricksmithproductions@gmail.com. That's for Hedrick Smith Productions. Just get in touch with us directly, and we can give them a hand. There's an outfit that distributes this stuff, but it's easier if they get in touch with us, and we can pass the word on.
Very good. Okay, so that's Making Schools Work, made in 2005, but as he said, seven models that work. Okay.
Successful models that work on a large scale.
That's right, that not just work in one school. I thought that was very good because, yes, everyone can point to the heroic teacher, the heroic principal, even the heroic superintendent, but you need more than that. Okay, let's shift. As I pointed out in my introduction, you've been looking at the issues that you talk about in the book, Who Stole the American Dream, for a long time. As you said, you experienced, as I did, the thriving middle class. What did you learn in researching and writing this book that surprised you?
I got to tell you, it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing. You know, I mean, I'm a pretty good reporter. At least I think of myself as a pretty good reporter, and apparently some other people did because they gave me a few prizes. But I really missed some very important stuff in the late 70s. I missed the fact that the Congress of 1978 was the pivotal Congress, the watershed Congress, where the changes really started, even before Reagan. So it was under Jimmy Carter, with the Democrats in control of both houses of Congress. But more importantly, I missed, and so did every reporter that I know. I never saw anybody write this up. It didn't really emerge until years later. Lewis Powell, who became a Supreme Court justice appointed by Richard Nixon in the end of 1971, I think he actually didn't sit on the court until the beginning of 1972, sat on the court for the next 16, 17 years, was sometimes a bridging force that pulled the arch-conservatives and the moderates and liberals on the court together. Lewis Powell was a big corporate attorney, a member of the Virginia aristocracy, spoke with a Tidewater drawl, was a very modest, self-effacing man. In fact, when people used to run into him in the court, they thought he might be one of the custodians. He didn't have a black robe on when he was walking around the court building, and so people misunderstood who he was. Lewis Powell was the Paul Revere.
Mm-hmm.
He was a corporate attorney. He was the Paul Revere for a political revolution that I believe had a major hand in stealing the American dream. Powell believed, and he wrote an essay called The Powell Memorandum in August of 1971, in which he said the American free enterprise system is under assault. It's under assault in academia. It's under assault from Ralph Nader and the consumer movement. It's under assault from the government, with all the new regulatory agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, the Mine Safety Board, all Traffic Safety Commission. By the way, all of those formed by Richard Nixon.
That's right.
Republican president. The irony of history that this guy was furious, not at Lyndon Johnson, the Democrat. He never uses Nixon's name, but it's Nixon's actions that provoked him. Anyway, he writes this essay. He says business must organize, must take power aggressively, must wage a long-term campaign, must pool its money, and must go after its enemies and change the direction of policy in America. Well, believe you me, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce circulated the Powell Memorandum, and it was like a trumpet call to corporate America. It was a manifesto, and all kinds of things started happening in the next few years. The Business Roundtable, which is the voice of the 150, 180 most powerful, largest corporations in America, didn't exist before the Powell Memorandum. Within 3 months, it had been formed by the big CEOs. The National Association of Manufacturers said, well, we better move our headquarters to Washington. The National Federation of Independent Businesses, which is the organization of small business, mushroomed from 3,000 members to 600,000 members. Corporations started opening offices in Washington. In 1971, Powell wrote his memo. There were 175 corporate lobbying offices in Washington. 9 years later, there were over 2,000. There were 50,000 staffers working for corporate trade associations by 1980. There were, 9,000 paid registered lobbyists for businesses and another 9,000 PR people. There were 130 corporate lobbyists for every member of Congress by the end of the 1970s. That was Powell's army. Powell had summoned them. By that time, he was on the court. He was no longer talking to them. He was making decisions on the cases they were bringing to the Supreme Court. But he started it. and it hit Jimmy Carter, Ralph Nader, the AFL-CIO, the consumer movement, like a thunderbolt. I mean, they started in the Congress of 1978 was the first pro-business Congress in years. The anti-business Congress of the early 70s became the pro-business Congress of the late 70s. It was a pivotal moment. It was like, you know, in a sports game, in a tennis match, in a football game, there's a tough struggle. Two sides are fighting fairly evenly, and then there's a game, there's a breakthrough, there's a touchdown, there's a rally in a baseball game, there's a tennis player that scores a service break. Something happens, and it's a game changer.
Yep.
Let me tell you, Terrence, this was the game changer in American history, and we have been living with the consequences of it ever since. Powell's army has only gotten stronger and stronger as the years have gone on. And I have to tell you, I'm embarrassed to say that although I sensed some of the details and some of the fallout from this thing, I did not know that. It's only the reporting that I did working on this book that taught me all the things that I just said to you.
Well, that's
stunning.
That says something in itself. Let me just tell people, because we're basically at the halfway point here. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Hedrick Smith about his new book, Who Stole the American Dream? And you can learn more at Hedrick Smith, one word, HEDRICK Smith.com. Now, Hedrick Smith will be...
I just need to emphasize, Terrence, that's why I called the book Who Stole the American Dream, because I understood that it was an organized effort. Now, it wasn't 12 guys sitting around a room, and Lewis Powell was not saying, I'm doing this to hurt the middle class.
No.
It's not in that sense, but there was a stealing that was going on. The wealth that the middle class had been accumulating during that long post-war period was about to start to be drained away by the captains of industry, by Wall Street, by the super rich, by the financial elite, very purposefully pursuing tax policies, deregulatory policies, blunting the drive of organized labor, blunting the drive of the consumer movement to the advantage of the elite and to the disadvantage of the middle class.
And one thing I don't think you mean to left out, but just in your short list there, the justice, the judicial system shifted about that same time. The Federalist Society and the Republican and conservative effort to change the courts, which has been...
There's no question.
Leads us to articles.
I'm not an expert on the court, and I don't really deal with the court in my book much, but I've read plenty of articles that literally have documented that since that period when Lewis Powell went on the court, that the court has rendered many more pro-business decisions than it did in the years before that. So
and of course, one of
the court certainly changed.
Yeah, and one of the things that's interesting in terms of making this all work is that every time someone comes up for confirmation, people talk about gun policy, people talk about abortion. Nobody talks about corporate decisions. Alito and Roberts are two very corporate-friendly justices, and the distraction that happens during confirmation hearings allows that to happen. The two things I wanted to mention, one is that tomorrow night...
You need to be fair about that. Even some of the so-called liberal justices appointed by Democratic presidents have gone along with a lot of...
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm just saying that the tilt that gives you Citizens United comes partially because, no one was looking at how do they rule on these sorts of issues. One of the things that occurred to me as you were talking about Powell was, if only whoever left the Supreme Court had left a few months earlier, and Nixon had appointed him a few months earlier, once he was in the Supreme Court, he couldn't have written the memo. History would be different.
Well, there are what-ifs all over here.
I know.
So I don't think there's a lot of future in going back over
No. It's just a funny thought.
He did write it, and it had enormous impact. Yeah. And that was something that we reporters at the time had no knowledge of. And I'm not certainly the first person who discovered this, but there are others who've written about it in the past. But it's still news. I can tell you, it's still news to most Washington insiders. I talked to a bunch of Washington biggie reporters and editors and so forth at an event just a few days ago, and it was a surprise to virtually every single one of them.
Oh, my God. That surprises me, okay? I'm saying I actually been talking about the Powell memo since about 1990. But there you go. You wrote an op-ed. I just want to set the scene of how things shifted. we were talking about how Nixon had, it had been the Nixon administration that passed OSHA, EPA, et cetera, et cetera. You had an op-ed just recently when Capitalist Care in the New York Times, and you quote Henry Ford, and then you quote, this is the one I'm going to read, though, just so people know how things have changed. Frank Abrams, chairman of Standard Oil of New Jersey, and Standard Oil of New Jersey, is that now part
of ExxonMobil?
That's ExxonMobil, yeah. Voicing the corporate mantra of stakeholder capitalism. This is the corporate mantra, and here's a quote from the chairman of what today would be ExxonMobil. The job of management is to maintain an equitable and working balance among the claims of the various directly affected interest groups, which he defined as stockholders, employees, customers, and the public at large. Nowadays, you'd be lucky to hear that sentiment from a Democratic candidate, never mind a titan of industry.
No question. Enormous change in business ethos has taken place. And we talked for a moment ago about the revolution, the business rebellion, the organized money of corporate America as one of the major factors in the stealing of the American dream from the middle class. The other major factor was what I call wedge economics. That is, economics that divide the profits and gains of the company and of the nation as a whole, but particularly of the company, from the standard of living, the wages of middle class, of average people. And we're not just talking here factory workers. We're talking salespeople. We're talking real estate agents. We're talking, computer programmers. We're talking health workers. The broad middle band in America. Wedge economics started to come in the late 70s, and you begin to see the ideas, the thinking of corporate America changing. Jack Welch, who was the CEO of General Electric, from, I forget when, it's somewhere in the mid-80s up until about 2000, was a totally different guy in his thinking from the guy who immediately preceded him, named Reginald Jones. Reginald Jones believed exactly what you just read from the guy who was the head of Standard Oil in New Jersey, that you had to practice stakeholder capitalism, that the success of your company, General Electric, depended on having happy workers who had a good, secure economic situation, a promising future, and shared benefits from the gains of American industry and the American economy. Jack Welch was cut it to the bone. There's no such thing as loyalty to the employee or loyalty to the company. All I want to do is deliver shareholder return, which means I'm worried about what Wall Street thinks about me as a CEO. Am I making enough money? Am I squeezing enough profit out of here? And can I run the stock price up? Because if I run the stock price up, the owners will make more money, and I will make more money from the stock options I'm going to get. That's a completely different view. In the old days, they didn't think you should take stocks from the company other than just buy it openly the same way an ordinary stockholder would, because they said that smacked of insider trading. Really interesting insight. Obviously, if you're inside the company and you know the company's about to come out with a new product, or it's just about to build a new plant, or conversely, it's in trouble, you know when to invest. So you do have inside information. And so they thought it was improper to take advantage of that. So their main pay was their salary and their bonuses, much more modest than the payoff from stock options, which is a manipulated casino game that we can take a look at if you want. But it's just unbelievable how much corruption there is in that game.
And when the notion of giving CEOs and big executives stock options came in, it was heralded as it would link their earnings more closely to performance and thus be a better way than just paying them, you know, what you thought they deserved.
Yeah, the idea was generated by Mike Jensen, an assistant professor of business in the Harvard Business School, and another guy at Rochester University. And the idea, they called it pay for performance. They were saying that there's a difference between the outlook and the incentives for a CEO from the owners. They're not necessarily after the same thing, but in order to align those interests to help the shareholders, why don't we pay the CEO more stock? Well, what they didn't reckon on, and eventually Jensen finally called, saw how the CEOs could manipulate this and game the market and talk up the stock price and cash in and make money, change the dates on their stock options in order to cheat the system, to guarantee themselves money. They weren't like stockholders at all. They were completely different. Jensen finally said, it's managerial heroin. You know, they're addicted to the stock options, and for good reason. I mean, people became 100 millionaires, and some of them became billionaires. I mean, Larry Ellison at
Oracle,
in 1 year walked away with $700 million in 1 year. Michael Eisner at Disney, I think, got about $400 million 1 year. And Sandy Weill at Citigroup had several years in which he made like between $150 million and $250 million a year. So, I mean, it's just unbelievable salaries. So by comparison, Charlie Wilson, the head of General Motors in the heyday of General Motors in the 50s and 60s and so forth, he made $600,000 a year. Translate that by inflation to modern salaries, he'd be $5 million. And he's a piker compared to the kind of money they're making today.
So, in small companies.
Way off the charts.
Yeah. And let me just, for people who want some numbers, these are a couple of things from your writing. Although productivity increased by 80.1% from 73 to 2011. Remember, we talked about 73 was when real wages for the middle class stopped climbing. It's year and a half after the Powell memo. So productivity increases by 80% from 73 to 2001. Average wages rose 4.2%. Hourly compensation, 10%. This is a period of 40 years.
38 years.
Yeah.
And the Census Bureau comes out in 2011, says the average male worker's hourly pay adjusted for inflation was the same or slightly lower in 2011 than in 1978. So you got 30 years of going nowhere while the CEO and the executive pay and Wall Street earnings are going through the roof.
Now, you point out that
I would call that stealing the American
economy. I would say, yeah, that's right. In other words, if someone steals something, somebody else has it, and it's clear who's got it. In Germany, this is again from that op-ed, but it's really, it grabbed my eye. In Germany, still a manufacturing export powerhouse, in fact, with a population of 83 million, either the number one or number two, depending on what currency you're doing, exporter in the world, average hourly pay has risen five times faster since 85 than in the United States.
Average German workers make more money than average American workers do. There's no question about it. And they work fewer hours, they have longer vacation, and they have better benefits.
And they have that safety net. Yeah, exactly.
And they have the safety net. Yeah. No question about
it. So they still have a social contract, which basically is what was stolen along with the American dream.
What's interesting is the answer to that you get, okay, fine. In fact, I actually got some emails that said this after that op-ed appeared. Okay, fine. That would be more ethical capitalism than we have today. That would be more moral capitalism. But if you did that, these are business executives saying this to me, CEOs and former senior executive vice presidents of major corporations writing me emails. If you did that, you couldn't survive as a company. Okay. That's the answer we get. Okay. So, and we couldn't survive as a country. You couldn't trade as a country. So if that's true, how come major German corporations like Siemens, Daimler Benz, and Mercedes, and BMW, and on and on and on. How come they're doing it and surviving and competing? And more importantly, how come in the face of cheap wages in China and India and the Asian tigers that the United States had a trade deficit in the 2000s, in the Bush decade, of $6 trillion. We bought $6 trillion more stuff than we were able to ship to the rest of the world, while Germany had a trade surplus, not a deficit, a surplus of $2 trillion. In other words, if the strategy Germany adopted would be suicidal for America, how come they performed better on the world market than we did? It suggests that there's some decisions that were made, or there may be some laws in this country, or there may be some different power situations. Trade unions are more powerful in Germany than in America. It's things about the society that spell out and explain those differences. It's not the global trade situation. It's not new technologies. It's not irresistible, impersonal market forces. It's the decisions specific political and business leaders have been making in this country versus the decisions being made in Germany and other countries.
Yeah, one other thing in Germany is every corporation that has 2,000 or more employees, half of the board is elected by the workers. Here, I don't even hear of a union demanding that in exchange for some thing they've given away.
No, but there were unions that did that. When United Airlines got in trouble, the unions took half the seats on the board, and employees in the company bought employee stock options and so forth. And then United went bankrupt, and all those employees lost all that money. They lost something like $3 billion in benefits. It turned out to be a bad deal.
Well, but not their positions on the board, but they're taking stock.
Yeah, they did both. They took seats on the board, and the union took stock, and the union members took stock. And the whole thing went bust. That also happened at Northwest Airlines and a couple of other companies. But you don't hear it much.
Right.
There are examples, but you don't hear it much.
Right. Okay, let's talk about I really appreciate what you said about wedge economics. And what you mean by that is separating the success of the company from the success of all the other stakeholders, but the shareholders and the top management.
Yeah, it's even broader than that. What we do in America, if you listen to economic experts on business programs, I don't care which cable network you listen to or which network you listen to, they'll all talk about how the American economy is doing. Growth this past quarter was 2% or 3% or 4%, whatever. And businesses are reporting profits and the Wall Street stock market is going up. And the implication of all those positive things, which have been said, by the way, just in the last couple of years, is that those are gains which are being shared fairly equally or fairly proportionally throughout the economy. Wedge economics stopped that. That used to be the case. When the country grew by 3 or 4% a year, people's living standards were rising 3 or 4% a year. Wages were increasing, something like that. That became a yardstick. That got all cut by wedge economics. And you can actually see it if you see a graph of what you just read to me. You can see two lines going up on a nice slant as if they were going uphill from 1943 to 1973. Wages going up, productivity going up, standard of living going up. And then suddenly there's a break at 1973. And the productivity line and the national gains line and the growth line keeps going up, and the wages and the standard of living line cuts and goes flat, and you just begin to see this big wedge between the growth and productivity and the level of income. And we need to get away from this shorthand assumption in our public conversation that gains for the nation and gains for the corporate profits get translated into gains for ordinary people. They don't. In some companies they do, but nationwide they don't. And that's got to get fixed.
No, it
doesn't matter who you elect in November. It doesn't matter which one you elect. Unless those people go change that dynamic, and that dynamic is mostly at work in the private sector, so it's not really up to government policy. But there are things you can do with the tax code, with regulatory measures, and a few other things that could influence it. But basically, no matter who you elect, it's not going to affect it much one way or another unless public opinion gets behind a fair sharing of America's economic gains.
Yeah, one thing it sounds to me is that journalists have they have a habit. We used to quote these numbers, we'll still quote these numbers as if they mean what they used to mean. And they don't anymore.
Well, I don't think journalism has covered itself in glory in recent years in America. I'm sorry to say that. But I don't think we've done a very good job. I mean, basically, I always figured my job as a reporter, what I owed my readers, what I owed my viewers on television, was to do roughly what an umpire does in a ball game: call balls and strikes, call people safe or out. How is the game being played? And when you do calling balls and strikes, you don't say to the batter, "Was that a strike? What do you think?" "Well, I think it was a ball." Then you say to the catcher, "What do you think? Was a ball a strike?" "I think it was a strike." Well, in journalism today, you ask the Republicans, is Obama against this? Yeah, he's against this. Then you ask the Democrats, "No, he's not against this." Okay, we've done our job. No, I'm sorry. There are some things that are a matter of opinion, but there are a lot of things that are a matter of fact, and our job as umpires is at least put the facts on the table and let the people make their decision. That's our job, and I don't think as a collection of journalists we've done a very good job of that, particularly in the last 10 or 15 years. It used to be more of a commitment, I think, years ago to say, sorry, You can say lower taxes will bring more growth, but the historical record shows the growth was better when taxes, maximum taxes under Eisenhower were 92% and 70% under Kennedy than when they were 35% under George W. Bush. That's not disputable. You can say what you want about lowering taxes, but the historical record is there. And we have an obligation to bring that out, it seems to me, and then let people, you know, make a decision based on those numbers that are in the historical record.
You had another op-ed recently that I find really important at this point in this conversation, and that was the one about public will, public protest. On the anniversary of the March on Washington in 63, and I'm just going to read a quote you say. There were 200,000 civil rights advocates marched on Washington peacefully. There is a lesson for us today in that scene, a lesson not just from the March on Washington, but from other populist movements of the 60s and 70s. These were manifestations of people power, of the political power of average Americans to shape public policy and make government work for ordinary citizens, not just for the financial elite and the political establishment. Not so today. Most Americans feel powerless. They've become disenchanted, disengaged, and effectively disenfranchised. In the telling insight of populist organizer Ernie Cortez, not only does power corrupt, but powerlessness also corrupts. Talk about that. Both what I'm asking you is, what happened and how do we change that?
Well, those are jackpot questions. So I'm glad they're coming at the end and not at the beginning of our conversation. People forget that ordinary Americans had an enormous influence and an enormous impact on policymakers in Washington for 20, 25 years, whether it was the civil rights movement demanding civil rights laws and voting rights, or the environmental movement demanding protection against pollution, or the consumer movement demanding better labeling, more honest labeling of products and safer products and so forth, or the Vietnam War, anti-war movement pushing to end the war, the labor movement just pushing for a higher standard of living and better conditions for labor union members, but actually for the middle class as a whole. A lot was achieved, and we've become so despondent. We've lost our civic faith, and that comment of Ernie Cortez, that powerlessness corrupts, it seems to me, is absolutely profound. He's talking about that famous saying of Lord Acton, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. But what he's saying is the feeling of being unable to affect your government, having no power in the hands of the people, that Washington pays no attention and there's nothing you can do about it, absolutely corrupts the very core of our democracy. Imagine how different the battles in Congress would have been in 2009 and 2010 if 10,000 people who had foreclosed out of their homes by banks that were just got bailed out by taxpayers had gone and camped on the Mall in Washington, as, by the way, people did during the Depression
exactly.
In the 1930s, and said, we aren't leaving until you lawmakers require the banks that got the taxpayer bailout for the banks themselves to bail out the homeowners that are stuck in these underwater homes with high bubble era interest rates and are a drag on the whole economy. I mean, the whole dynamic would have been different. I kept sitting there as a reporter who had covered and watched all these demonstrations in the 60s and 70s, waiting for the people to show up. You know, the first people that showed up were the Occupy people a couple of years later in Wall Street and elsewhere around the country, and it didn't have the same impact as if actually middle-class folks who were being shoved out of their homes had said, hey, wait a minute, this isn't fair. You know, we're willing to pay our mortgage, but this is an unreasonable mortgage, and we're trapped in a house that's worth less than what we owe. We can't afford the mortgage. We're trying to meet the payments, and the bank won't even listen to us when we say, how about giving us a loan at a lower interest rate? So, I mean, I don't know how we're going to get there. I think the only way we're going to get there is when people finally get angry enough and conclude that all the promises the politicians are making aren't going to work unless there's people power forcing Washington to respond to a genuine middle-class agenda. I mean, our history shows that it can happen.
It can with a pot. They're saying positively, it can happen when
I'm absolutely
when the middle class
can happen. It has happened. It's happened repeatedly. It's happened in one sphere after another. It's not like there was one successful movement. I'm talking here about five or six different movements and different areas of policy, all of which had powerful impact and had impact on politicians who actually disagreed with the movements, but they understood that they'd better go along with a political tide from the public.
Yeah.
I mean, Richard Nixon was no environmentalist. He passed a lot of environmental legislation. He did it because it was practical politics.
Exactly. Okay, we've got to leave it at there, and we will be waiting for those people to show up. And we'll be waiting to see what Occupy does. You know, their anniversary is also tomorrow night, the first anniversary of when they first occupied Wall Street. So we'll see what happens if it can be reborn and if it makes a difference. Again,
if we wait to see what happens, it won't happen. We have to decide that we're going to do it ourselves.
Excellent. That's the words of Hedrick Smith. The book is Who Stole the American Dream. The website is hedricksmith.com. That's H-E-D-R-I-C-K Smith. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime of the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. You can do both of those things at my site or at iTunes. My site is Terrence McNally, T-E-R-R-E-N-C-E, McNally, M-C-N-A-L-L-Y.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and two or three articles to give you background on the issues, you can do that at my site or email me at T.E. McNally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y at mac.com. You can also check out Free Forum with Terrence McNally on Facebook. You can follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Finally, thank you to Hedrick Smith. Keep up the good work.
Thanks so much. Enjoyed being with you.
Okay.